Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Sam Burnett.
And I'm Kendall Stormo.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for the show is Talk to the Hand. We have stories of taking a stand, getting scorned, and doing it your way.
Sam and I are filling in for your usual hosts, Rosie Robards and Jason Brandeis.
We'll start the show with a story told by local blogger and interior designer, Fernanda Conrad. After escaping the high walls of an Ecuadorian nunnery, she ventured to the last frontier in 2001.
Here's Fernanda Conrad, live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
It takes a lot of work to be a legal immigrant in this country. I should know. I came here 15 years ago from Ecuador as an exchange student, for which I had to do a lot of paperwork. After that, I fell in love with Alaska, and I decided that I wanted to go to UAA. So I did a lot more paperwork to get a student visa, and I went there for 4 years. Well, 4 years later, I graduated and someone offered me a job, so I had to do a lot more paperwork to get a work visa. And as luck may have it, a couple of years after that, I met a wonderfully quiet, blue-eyed introvert who won me over with his demure behavior and who eventually became my husband. Well, when you get married to someone in this country and an American and you are not from here, all of your visas get taken away and then you are granted permanent residency in the form of a green card, for which you have to do more paperwork. So at this point, I am a seasoned veteran at Immigration Affairs. After all, I've been doing this for over 10 years. So I tell my husband, I got this. I'm good. We're fine. I know how to do this. And in fact, because I know it's a lot of work, I'm going to lawyer up and get ourselves a lawyer, and he's going to help us because this is going to be a lot of work, a lot of paperwork, and this is just going to get easier that way. So, indeed, the lawyer is very helpful, and he helps us get all the paperwork that we need in order to prove that our marriage is indeed legit. Among these papers that we need to get are affidavits from our friends swearing to the government that they have seen us kiss at least once. Also, pictures of us having fun. Bank statements and credit card statements and anything that we own together, our house, our car, our cell phone bills, all of that goes into this big fat file. And then the last thing that you have to do is an interview with a U.S. consul, for which our lawyer gave us a list of questions that we just needed to go over in order to make sure that we were prepared for this meeting. So for the next couple months after we get the questionnaire, we just spend our date nights quizzing each other. Super romantic, you guys. What is my favorite color? What side of the bed do I sleep on? What color is your toothbrush? What is my favorite brand of shoes? What are you allergic to? You know, just little things that if you are in a legitimate relationship, technically should just be second nature to know. So we go over this over and over for a couple of months until we are solid. I mean, we are ready, we are gonna go, and we're gonna rock this, it's fine. And the day of the interview comes, and we go downtown to the Office of Immigration and Naturalization Services, and we walk into this office and sit across this very young and very kind lady consul. And we sit in this order, my lawyer and my husband and I, across from her. She comes in and she sits down and she turns on a video camera behind her and she opens the big fat file with my entire life in it and starts asking questions. So state your names for the record and how did you meet? And what do you guys do for work? And she just starts going over questions that, you know, we have gone over, so it's all fine. And at this point in time, since I am on stage right now, you have probably realized that I am the talkative extrovert in this relationship. So I am the one fronting all the questions, and I think I'm doing a fabulous job. You know, just answering them all, and I'm like, I know that one, I know that one, I know that one, I'm good. Well, I think she got tired of hearing my voice because she turned to my husband and point blank asked him, so tell me what you love about Fernanda. Five seconds go by. Ten seconds go by. Nothing. It starts getting awkward really quick. And my lawyer on the other side starts looking at him like, dude, you gotta come up with something, man. Like, anything. Really. Nada. So I start getting a little bit anxious at this point and a little bit pissed off and a little bit worried, to tell you the truth. I mean, I did marry this guy who doesn't know what he loves about me. So I kick him underneath the table and I'm like, dude, not for real. Answer the nice lady, you know, tell her what you love about me. Nope. So it was awkward enough that the consul said, well, just let's close up this file and thank you and we'll let you know. So we walk out of her office and into a waiting room and my lawyer stays inside with her. And I turn to my husband in the waiting room and I am pissed. So I ask him, what the hell were you thinking? And you know what his answer was? That question was not in the questionnaire. So I am literally about to kill him with my bare hands when my lawyer comes out and reassures me. And you know, it's probably going to be fine. You know, you just need to, you know, wait and see. A letter will come in the mail. So we go home and I am packing because it's the only thing I can do because surely I'm about to get deported. And the next 2 weeks were so painful, so very painful, watching the mail every day until the letter did arrive and I opened it. And you know what? It may have been the fact that the lady consul was young and inexperienced, or it maybe was that she took pity on us, or maybe it was the fact that she is also married to a quiet introvert and she knows how these things go. But God bless her anyway, because when I opened that letter, it said, welcome to the United States.
You just heard Fernanda Conrad, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about true personal events from their lives. Our theme for this show is Talk to the Hand.
Now we hear from Service High School student Lizka Bezanier, who reminds us what things were like back in elementary school.
It started as a conversation with my family around the dinner table in 2011. We were discussing the Arctic Refuge, a topic that we are all familiar with. We had been to the refuge in 2008 on a week-long camping trip. The drive up there was filled with the buzzing of our excitement as well as the increasing number of mosquitoes. I imagined that there would be gates to drive through, maybe a sign that said, "Welcome, you are now entering the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge." Instead, we parked next to a lake and started walking. Even though it rained the whole time that we were there and I was eaten alive by the mosquitoes, I wasn't miserable. In fact, I was perfectly content with how real and how big and how alive everything was. It was stunning. And camping trips like these weren't uncommon to me and my family. My parents are both avid nature enthusiasts and my father is an environmental lawyer. They raised my sister and I like flowers. Lots of dirt, lots of water, lots of sunlight. My passion for the outdoors grew as I saw more of it. So, when our conversation around the dinner table turned to the Arctic Refuge, my ears perked up. My father mentioned that the federal government was making decisions based on whether they should allow drilling in the Arctic Refuge's coastal plain, and this concerned me. I couldn't just sit by and watch as my refuge was put on the line. I wanted to do something about this, but what could I do? I was only 11 years old in sixth grade. So I asked my dad, and he said that I could write a letter to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They were creating a new management plan that was including a comment section, and I could submit my letter. So I sat down at the dinner table with a piece of lined paper in my hand and a pencil in my hand, or a piece of paper on the table and a pencil in my hand, and I started writing. "Dear Fish and Wildlife Service, we support protecting formal refuge in the wilderness, or formal wilderness in the refuge. The refuge is one of the last great wildernesses. There, the animals thrive in natural homes. We need to protect the land and wildlife so that the lovers of them can continue to come. That reason is simply one of the many others there are. Some people haven't been able to see the glory of the refuge. Many want to. For those that have, hold it in a special place in their hearts." These comments are submitted by the following people of Alaska. But, I mean, I was in sixth grade, and there was a lot of grammatical errors and spelling errors and commas in weird places, but I think I got the point across. But I wasn't just satisfied with this. I wanted to do more for the refuge. I wanted more people to know about this huge issue. So I asked my dad if I could bring it into my class to get some of my friends to sign it. He said yes, and I brought it in the next day. I walked into school really excited, and I brought it to my teachers first to see if maybe they wanted to sign it. But they saw my letter, and they got really concerned. And this was confusing. They even had to bring it to the principal's office. And I couldn't understand this. My teachers at Bowman Elementary had always taught me to speak my mind about issues that mattered a lot to me, and I never thought that people wouldn't want to hear them. But they came back a couple minutes later and told me that I couldn't get any signatures on school grounds or during school hours. And this was still really confusing, but I wasn't going to fight the system on this one, so I let it be. They let me read my letter to the class and then suggested that everyone go home and talk to their parents about the Arctic Refuge and drilling before signing my letter, and I was okay with this. But I came into school the next day, and now I was really excited. I had a new pen in my pocket, and I was totally convinced it was going to run out of ink with all the signatures that I was going to get. But I walked into class, and my stomach sank. There was a boy standing there whose father worked with the oil industry. He was wearing a collared shirt and had a white plastic three-ring binder in his hands. We had a class discussion, but it quickly turned into a debate. Me and the wilderness versus Nick and Big Oil. Nicholas's white binder contained graphs and figures about oil spills and cleanups, about how much money drilling makes and how beneficial it would be for our economy. Every time he spouted out a number from a par graph or pie graph or a bar graph or a line graph, my stomach sank a little bit more and my heart beat a little bit faster. I tried to drown out his voice by chomping on my pretzels loudly. It didn't work. I wasn't prepared to this. I was completely blindsided by Nicholas's binder and his preparation. I had nothing to defend the Arctic Refuge with other than my heart and soul telling me that this mattered a great deal to people, even if they never see the refuge. I don't think the rest of the class listened very much, no matter how loudly I chomped on my pretzels or how many numbers Nick spouted. But there we were, two little 11-year-olds who were fighting with the support of our parents who were acting on behalf of some of the largest industries in the world. We could both feel the power, and we were both insanely proud of our parents and who we were and what we were fighting for, and neither one of us was going to give up. The rest of the class day left in a blur and passed in a blur, and I remember standing outside, not on school grounds, of course, and after school, and I was trying to warm up my pen in between my hands because it was November and it was cold outside and the ink wouldn't run right. And of course, there was no table outside, so we didn't have anything to sign it on. So the people that wanted to sign my letter had to sign on my hand, and their signatures didn't come across quite smoothly, but I could still feel the power, and I knew that what I was doing was right. And I know that the school made it a lot harder for me to get these signatures, but I was insanely proud of how I still was getting them. I could tell that I was doing something big. I realize now that this passion for wilderness has always been inside of me. My father has the same one, and sometimes he struggles with his. He spends long hours in front of his desk working hard on his computer, and I'm outside playing in the snow in the winter, building tree forts in the summer. Sometimes I kind of want to be like him. I want to devote my whole life to protecting the wilderness for future generations to come. But other times, I kind of just want to get out there and see up close and explore all these places that he's working so hard to protect. Oh, and by the way, I got 3 signatures on my letter. Thank you.
That was Lizka Besenier, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Sam Burnett.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. We're hearing stories on taking a stand, getting scorned, and doing it your way.
We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans. Jeff Lucas has lived here for 8 years now, but this story takes place before his Alaska days.
Well, it was the 80s, and I worked for an insurance company, and they transferred me and my young family, my 2 girls and my wife, to Utah. And my wife was not happy with this move. She was very skeptical of the whole Mormon thing, and I tried to tell her, everything is going to be just fine. You know, this is America. These people are just like us. We're going to have a ball. And what about the skiing? Anyway, it wasn't 2 months, and she came to me, and she said, somebody's stalking us. And I said, what? What are you talking about? And she goes, yeah. This guy shows up in a black car. He stops in front of our house. He sits there for a minute. He drives on, and I'm going, big deal. He goes, no, he does it over and over and over again. And I'm going, how do you know? I mean, what are you, looking outside all the time? She goes, I can tell by the sound of his snow tires. I'm thinking, yeah, it's winter in Utah. I mean, a lot of people have snow tires. Anyway, as the, I have to tell you, I was skeptical, and I have to admit, I ignored her. And as the year went by, according to her, he came by several more times, and finally we got to summer, and it stopped. And I said, imagine that. The snow tire noise has stopped. Anyway, I thought that we'd pass that, and as time went by, we started going out, and we went to a play one night, and as we returned, we're pulling into our street, and all of our neighbors are out in front of our house, and there's a cop car there, and the lights are on the car, and we immediately park, and we go over to the babysitter and her dad in the front yard, and they're talking to the cops, and I can hear her giving the story to the cops, and it's the exact same story that my wife tells me. In fact, even the creepy snow tires are in the story. And I'm thinking, crap. Anyway, I notice that she gives the license plate number to the guy, the cop, and I'm wondering what the cops are going to do. But he turns to me and he says, we checked this out. It's nothing to worry about here. Forget about it. And I'm going, you've got to be kidding me. Aren't you concerned about the out-of-season snow tire use? I mean, and he even gets more emphatic and he says, there's nothing here. And he leaves, and he just drives away. And I, frankly, am nervous at this point. I mean, I've kind of taken this personal. And I'm beginning to wonder, you know, who is this guy? So I go to the dad. He's got the license plate number. And I take the plate, and I run it at a guy that owns a wrecking yard. And he comes back, and it's a 1983 Audi. And the guy's just like me. I mean, he's got about my age, and thinking, So I do a little more looking, and I wonder, you know, I have a job where I make decisions about money, and well, I wonder if this guy's got an axe to grind. But I check it against all my lists at work, and I don't know this guy at all. So I figured, I wonder what's going on. At any rate, time goes by, nothing really happens, but eventually he starts coming back again. And me and the neighbors, everybody is out chasing this guy away from the front of my house. And I'm beginning to really worry, and my wife is terrified. So I finally say to her, you know, if he comes by again, we're going to take care of him. And we come up with a plan. The plan involves me dressing up. You know, I had an old motorcycle jacket, you know, black. And I had some cowboy boots. And the idea was, if he comes by again, if she hears the snow tires again, I was going to jump down, go down in my clothes, go down to the car, jump in the car, put the garage door up, and turn the lights off and wait for him to come by again. And then I was going to slip in right behind him, hopefully find out what's going on. Okay. He said, you know, and this was one of those stupid plans. I mean, I could get shot doing this, you know? So sure enough, that next night, he shows up, and we execute the plan. I go down, I jump in the car, I wait for him, he goes by, I get right behind him, I hit the brights, and he is heading out, breaks off his normal route around the neighborhood, and I get right behind him. And I wait for him to get to a traffic light, and he stops, and I jump out, and I run up to his car, and I bang on the quarter panel, and the guy sticks his head out, and he looks at me, and I'm thinking, this is it. I'm going to end up getting shot right now. But the guy goes, and he gets out of the car, and we start to walk towards one another. And we do that funny little man-crab walk, you know? You know, you're kind of walking like this, because you don't, you know, you're trying to protect this area right here, the daddy part. And anyway, we get up close to one another, and I'm wondering what's going to happen. And the guy says, I didn't think anybody noticed. And I thought, you got to be kidding me. But, you know, it's funny. It just totally disarmed me. And I didn't challenge him. I just said, and I listened to him. And the guy said, I've been seeing a woman. And when I drive by and stop in front of your house, and I look at my driver's light, my driver's door window, I can see a window in the back of her house. And if that light is on, I know her husband's gone, and it's safe to come by. Are you kidding me? I mean, I've been terrified for a year because you've been horny to have sex with this woman? Anyway, I go and I basically shrug my shoulders, and I said, I understand. And I walked away, and I went home, and I told my wife the story, and we all had a good chuckle, and I never noticed the guy again.
That was Jeff Lucas live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Each month, the Arctic Entry Storyboard works with 7 people to share their stories live on stage. Anyone can pitch a story. Check arcticentries.com for details.
Each season, the Arctic Entry Storyboard selects a nonprofit partner. The proceeds from the live shows go to that organization.
This year, proceeds go to Facing Foster Care in Alaska. Our next story is told by their executive director, Amanda Metavir.
I knew early on that my life wasn't normal, but I always thought that I was destined for greatness. Growing up, my parents drank a lot. I spent the majority of my childhood trying to survive in an environment of chronic abuse and neglect. By the time I was 16, I had been on the run multiple times, dropped out of high school, and had pretty much given up all hope for anything involved in my future. I had started my own journey with the justice system at that point. I quickly landed in foster care. I didn't realize at the time how lucky I was. A lot of young people in the system have to endure switching foster care homes multiple times, changing schools. I was so fortunate to have one foster family who loved me unconditionally and went out of their way more times than one to make sure that I was safe and had opportunities to succeed as an adult. No matter how much I pushed, they came back and gave me opportunities to be successful. At one point, I stole their minivan They called a family meeting and said, "We love you. What do you need?" I couldn't figure out why they wouldn't get rid of me. After a few years in the foster care system, I got a call from my caseworker. She said the state was working to develop a youth advisory board. They were calling on a team of experts, youth like me, who had spent time in the system, lived and breathed it every day. They wanted our feedback on how to improve it. I was not interested in this at all. I didn't consider myself a foster child. I had a lot of shame and guilt associated with that. And I wasn't about to go out and hang out with a bunch of foster kids either and have a group therapy session. So a few months went by and I got another call asking me again if I would come and be a part of this youth advisory board. This time it was a little bit different. I had finally finished my GED. I was in college working on my own degree at this point in social work and really trying to make a life for myself. I was going to age out of the system soon, and I wasn't sure what was going to happen next. I attended this meeting, and for the first time in my life, I felt like I belonged because of my experience. All the shame and guilt and things associated with my history and things that had happened in my life and living with strangers, it just felt normal to be able to talk to other youth who had the same fears as me. They didn't know where they were going to go next. They didn't know what was going to happen in their life without a safety net, and we all sort of band together. There was a woman there facilitating our meeting. She called herself a foster care alumni. I like that term. It sounded like she graduated from something. She told us that we were going to change the face of child welfare in Alaska by sharing our stories. I thought that sounded like a crock. Who is going to listen to a bunch of foster kids? Who is going to take us seriously? Over the next several months, we kept meeting. We adopted a name, Facing Foster Care in Alaska. And collectively, we felt really empowered. We felt comfortable around each other enough to share our stories, and we felt normal. And we got out and we started talking to people. We started talking to foster parents and caregivers and social workers and even judges. And people were listening. And we were calling out major systemic flaws with our child welfare system. Issues around youth aging out of the system to homelessness, bouncing between homes, not graduating high school, being over-medicated. People were listening. And the state had given us that platform and that opportunity. Well, apparently they didn't really like what we were saying. As we started to formalize as a group, I was elected president. I got a call one day from the state saying that they loved what we were doing, they loved our advocacy, they still wanted us to give input to them, but youth couldn't speak publicly anymore without a court order. When you're in foster care, there's these protections in place. Things like, back then I couldn't get a driver's license or stay the night at a friend's house without a background check. I wasn't even allowed to jump on a trampoline. These are all things that were meant to keep us safe and also minimize liability for the state. When you're in the system, you're property of the government. So something else that was meant to keep us safe was also meant to keep us quiet. We kind of fumbled around. We didn't really know what to do, but we know this was sort of like a formal legal thing, and maybe we needed an attorney. Attorneys are really good to have. I called a friend at the Office of Public Advocacy and told her the situation, what was going on, and also explained that we didn't have any money, but she got us an attorney. So we felt really empowered. We had this meeting with this attorney who explained to us that there's a statute, Alaska statute, AS 47-1090-D, that says the name or picture of a child in foster care cannot be released publicly without a court order. So she got us court orders. So we kept showing up to these events and speaking, and I had my little packet of court orders, and we felt really good and formal and like we had it together. I got called into the office of a state lawmaker one day. He was going on about how he wanted to do some advocacy in foster care. He wanted to help increase the foster care rate. So we show up to a meeting at his office, and I bring a group of other foster youth. My friend Becca, who had been in foster care at that point for over a decade and had more than 20 placements, and another young woman named Farron, who was in a similar situation. We had never met with anyone this important before. We were super nervous. We sat in my car in the parking lot for an hour. I rambled on about how we needed to be professional and watch our language. This guy was a policymaker. We walk in, there's State Representative Les Guerra lying on the couch, in a pair of hiking boots, eating a bowl of chili. A little less formal than we had expected. He went on about how he wanted to increase the foster care rate and have a big press conference, and he wanted us there to talk about our lives and our experiences, and that would help. And I just passed over a copy of the statute printed out that said, we can't do that without a court order. And he read it, and he looked up, and he goes, what? This is And I looked at the youth like, language. Les gets up, he walks over, he calls the state's attorney general at the time, Talis Kohlberg, and we're like, oh my God, what have we done? He tells him it's unconstitutional, it's against our First Amendment right, and demanded a letter overturning the statute or reinterpreting it, telling us that yes, we could speak publicly without a court order. So about 2 weeks went by, I got a fancy letter in the mail with a state seal on it that said not only could you speak publicly, they could also have their name or picture released as long as they were self-disclosing. Next thing I know, Channel 2 is in my living room. Me, Becca, and Farron are there on the 6 o'clock news. Maria Downey comes on and talks about how the state tried to put a gag order on foster children to shut us up. So not only do we now have an opportunity to speak public, we have a platform to talk about the issues. So we went on about, yeah, the state tried to shut us up, but here's what's really going on. And it was our first big opportunity to fight for something that was important to us. Not only freedom of speech for us, but for foster youth throughout the state. It's been 10 years now since the gag order was lifted. Facing Foster Care in Alaska has grown into a thriving, sustainable nonprofit. We've served hundreds of youth throughout the state, teaching them how to share their stories, how to impact change. We've passed multiple pieces of legislation, both state and federal. We've won a class action lawsuit, and we're this year's nonprofit partner for Arctic Entries.
That was Amanda Metivier on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
KSKA would like to alert listeners that the following contains language that may be offensive.
Our next storyteller was raised in Anchorage and is the mother of four sons. She shares this story about her eldest.
Here's Ann Garrett.
So the first thing you need to know about me was that I was a really, really, really good kid. I mean, really good. My mom was a teacher, and I was raised here in Anchorage, and she was the director of music at Central Lutheran over on 15th in Cordova. And I was at church 2-3 times a week and 3 times on Sundays, so even if I had wanted to get in trouble, there was no way. Everyone knew everything I did, so basically, I didn't do anything. And I didn't like that. A bit. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke, I didn't swear, and I was a good, good kid. So, needless to say, no one was more surprised than I was when I got pregnant at 22 and I was a single mom. And my mom said, please tell me this was the second immaculate conception. I said, no, mom, we had sex. From that point on, my mom's primary mission was to marry me off to the nice Lutheran farm boy that she found. He had to play baseball, and he had to be very tall and very handsome, but he had to be Lutheran. So pretty much anyone would do as far as she was concerned, and every time I would meet somebody at church, she'd be like, what about him? What about him? What about him? What about him? And it got old pretty quickly, and it became clear that the village that I was raised by was not a village I wanted to live in. So when Blair Marowitz, a really nice Jewish boy that I met at a party 2-3 weeks before, suggested that I take my PFD and cash it in and go with him backpacking around Europe with my 13-month-old son, I thought, that's a great idea. Needless to say, the minute we got to London, we decided we were not meant to be. And so we decided, though, we would backpack parallel throughout Europe together for 4 or 5 months, me with my backpack and my little towhead blonde boy who was just adorable, and him with his Tai Chi, and it was fun. And then we went our separate ways, and I realized at that point, there was no way in hell that I could go So I moved to Boston, where I had a couple friends, and I moved in with some vegetarians, even though I wasn't a vegetarian. I set meat on the side. And I, you know, basically just started a whole new life. And 2 years later, I met a really nice Catholic boy, and my mom was like, yes, someone is finally willing to marry this girl. It didn't matter that his name was Anil Jesus Enrique Singularis, and that he was part Indian and part Spanish. He was good enough. So we got married, and it should have been assigned to me when that redoubt erupted. But we still got married. And we moved to Seattle, so we were closer to home, and started our family. And that's none too soon, because it turned out I was pregnant. My mom was like, well, at least you got this one right. So Jonathan, the baby, was now 6, and he was very, very interested in this pregnancy. I was like, you know, wanted to know all the details. And being the progressive liberal mom that I was like, happy to tell him. So we talked about it. I went out and I got the VHS copy of The Miracle of Life. And we put that on and we wore that thing out. We had to get a second copy. And sometimes I'd be like, do you want to watch Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? Or do you want to watch Miracle of Life? And he couldn't, he was torn. Truly, truly torn. So I was pretty proud of this way everything worked out until the day he came home from kindergarten and he learned a new word. Excuse me? This was not in my parenting handbook. I ran to the Barry Brazelton book I had. What do I do? What do I do? What do I do? The child is screaming. What do I do? It says, just ignore him. Swearing gives him power. Do not give him that power. I'm like, I can do this. I got this. Want a juice box? Yes. So I decided this was not going to stand. I had to take matters into my own hand. I sat my son down and I said, hey honey, you know that movie that you love so much, The Miracle of Life? And he's like, yes, with the zygotes and the blast, the ovum. I'm like, yeah, that's right. So you know that word that you love so, so much? So I thought it'd be really important, you know, that you learn what that word actually meant. You know, so you could use it properly. And he was, you know, okay, that makes sense. So I said, you know the part in The Miracle of Life where the man and the woman make the baby? And he's like, where the sperm implants itself into the ovum. And I'm like, before that. He's like, where the millions of sperm race valiantly up into the woman to get, and I'm like, no, before that. Before that. And his face gets a little white. And I said, the part where the man puts his penis in the woman's vagina, and his eyes got huge. He's like, I know about that. And I said, well, so that's what that word means. Except they're not actually married. And he's like, what? I said, yes. And they're not actually having a baby. What? They do that when they don't need to make a baby. And they do it a lot. A lot. And he looks at me and he says, I don't think I need to use that word. And I think, I'm writing the next parenting book. So I'm proud of myself for about 2-3 days. I'm like, I am the best mom, as my kids will tell you, as I make them tell me every day. The best mom in the whole wide world. But then he came home from playing at the neighbor's house and he said, you know that kid John next door? He does not know what that word means. I'm like, John? The child with the homeschool family that's from Montana, that's like really fundamentalist Christian baby. He said, yeah, he doesn't know what that word means, but don't worry, I explained it to him. Mom says she's going to come over soon and she's going to say thank you. It's all going to be great. It's all worked out.
You just heard from Anne Garrett.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our next story is from Susan Maley.
Here she is live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
Let me tell you about the time I bought a bobcat. Not the kind with wheels and an engine, the kind with fangs and fur. I was visiting my sister Jackie in a small Texas town, and two good friends from Hawaii, Katie and Elmo, came to visit me there, and we all trooped down to the local trade fair. And there it was, a caged, snarling, tan bobcat in the back of a pickup truck, next to the con praline table. Now, the big guy in the coveralls standing next to the truck bed was selling it to be taxidermied, his business. Not to be worn to ward off the cold, but to be stuffed and stand there for somebody who hadn't hunted. Now, I wear fur as well as fleece for warmth, but this just wasn't right. So we go back to Jackie's house and call Texas Wildlife to find out, are there restrictions about selling bobcats? And it turns out there's not, because they're predators. Now, I don't get this, because we're predators, and we can even get protective custody. So we decide that we're going to do something about this, and Katie and I have some cash, and Jackie knows where there's wildlife sanctuary that we can release the bobcat. So we decide to go back and offer $100. And when we do, the seller gets kind of coy and says, now you're not gonna be keeping it in a cage, are you? Or selling it to a zoo, because I don't hold with caging critters. So the deal did get done. And after the money exchange came the cat transfer. And the seller had a smaller cage back at his place, so we all caravanned out there. And it was quite the scene. There were numerous cages around his property with more bobcats and other small animals. This guy was running a taxidermy to-go operation. And our bobcat was scared and scary, still snarling and snapping, and no amount of prodding by the big guy would get it to come out of its cage into the smaller one that was butted up against it. Finally, he turned the hose on the cat hard, and it shot from one cage to the other. So it was still kind of shocked and quiet while we loaded it into Elmo's pickup truck. So off we all go, wired and rung. On the way out to the refuge, my sister was in the lead car with her son, Nathan. And he says, Mama, why are Auntie Susan and Katie buying that bobcat? And she said, it's because they don't have to buy anybody $100 sneakers. She's got the best line. She's one of the funniest people I know. So we call this our $100 day, and ourselves pals of predators. POP for short. This was our one meeting. Stop while you're ahead. So Northeast Texas prairie in the wintertime is dun brown. And after traveling about 30 minutes through it, we get to the refuge. And as we turn in, I see the second line on the sign that says something like bird or waterfowl sanctuary. Yeah. Great just great. Now we're on the imported predator program. So we turned down a side road by a dry creek bed to try to escape detection in this now clandestine escapade. And it's time to practice what we preach. The cat's still in the cage. Now there are folks who know about wild animals and cages. We were not them. We were too nervous to open the cage from the front because we didn't want it springing out at us. And so we all crammed in the cab of the pickup truck and took turns dangling out of the cab rear window, going over the back to try to release it from the front with a variety of improvised implements, including purse straps. So in between, we are laughing somewhat hysterically because we don't know what to do. And the longer we wait, the better the chance of somebody discovering us, like a birder or somebody with a badge. So finally, Elmo gets out of the truck, walks around to the back, releases the latch, swings the door open, and steps to the side of the truck. The cat's coiled at the back of the cage, and then it springs and bolts, and it's so fast, this undulating muscle mass now freed, bounding down the brown creek bed, turning its head mid-stride to look at us like, what was that? Then banked off a curve and was gone.
That was Susan Maley, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Our theme for this show is Talk to the Hand. We have stories of taking a stand, getting scorned, and doing it your way.
Our next storyteller is English professor Shane Castle. Here he is live on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So I don't know if you've noticed, but there are a lot of people in this country right now who just seem perfectly willing to give up on humanity and just embrace the sort of darker impulses that they have, maybe even make policy out of it. And I just want to tell a story tonight that suggests that sometimes we can actually find our own humanity at that exact moment when we think it's lost. I was 19 years old, and at that time I was super concerned with figuring out all my dimensions, and that meant like what I could do, what I was willing to do, and what I could get away with. And I was also really into my own physicality, kind of like narcissistically probably, but I would like, I was lifting weights a lot, I was about 20 pounds heavier, just solid muscle, I was strong, fast, I was playing rugby and I was really good at that, and I was getting into a lot of fights and winning. And so that summer, I went out to Washington, D.C. to visit my best friend, Jack. And Jack, at the time, was a punk. And he had like a 10-inch mohawk, and he'd wear like a black leather jacket with patches all over it, and he'd have like tight plaid pants. And all his friends were punks, and they drew a whole bunch of negative attention toward themselves everywhere we went. And one time, while I was there, we went to Baltimore. And Baltimore is a place where you can learn a lot about yourself. We went down to Fells Point, and Fells Point's this kind of gentrified historic district where people go on the weekends and hang out. And we went past where everyone's hanging out, we took some beers, and we went down to this wharf, and we kind of did our own thing and minded our own business. And on the way back, there were just like a couple of kids, and they're about our age, but a little younger, and they're sitting up against this wall, and they're just pointing and laughing and just making fun of my friends. And because I was a tough guy, I thought I had to go around everywhere drawing lines in the sand. And so my line that night was, you don't make fun of people for the way they dress or look, especially when they're my friends. And I went over to them, and we kind of had words, and I lightly, and I mean this, I'm serious, lightly stepped back and kicked one of them in the head. And I step back and I just get ready to fight. And they jump up and they're ready to fight, but they don't fight like I fight because they have box knives. they start chasing us around, and we just kind of run around cars. We're just trying to keep space between us, so we're just going around and around these cars, and it works for a minute, but then it breaks down, and we have to run, and as we're running, the one I kicked catches my friend Chris in the back of the arm with his razor and cuts his arm open, and we just realize it's starting to get serious, and we need to keep running, and pretty soon, Jack's little brother and I are in this plaza, kind of where there are more people, and we're safe, but I don't see Jack in them. I look over and I see these kids, and now there's like four or five of them, and they're all congregating in this one little space, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting my friends killed because of something I did. I gotta go help, so I take off running over towards them, and as I get up to them, I see my friends have actually ducked into a corner bar and they're safe. These guys are just outside taunting them, and now I'm running at them at full speed. And I think, hey, maybe I can just keep running and they won't notice. But they did, and they come in behind me, and I'm running down this sidewalk in this foreign city, and they're just like behind me, and people are scattering out of my way. And I started thinking, you know, I am actually really fast. I'm like not just sports fast, like I'm streets fast, because I'm blowing these guys away. But I also realize I'm getting out past where all the people are, where it's a little safer. It's getting sketchy. Now I need to be smart. So I decide I'm going to take a left, and I'm going to loop back. So I go around this brick building, and I'm running. I go halfway down the block. There's an alley on my left, and I take the alley, and I run into a chain-link fence. And it's okay. I scramble over that chain-link fence. I land in this courtyard. It's like a big courtyard between these big brick buildings, debris, junk everywhere. And I'm like, this is the perfect place for like where junkies hang out and hide. And there's one more fence in front of me, so I start running toward it, and I'm going to jump it, but I'm not as smart as I thought I was because these guys have split up, and now two of them are coming around in front of me. And I look back, and the one that I kicked and the one that same guy that had cut Chris is coming over the fence. And I know right in that moment exactly what's going to happen. I know that I'm going to be trapped and outnumbered. This guy's coming over the fence. He's going to immediately start hacking and slashing at me, and I'm going to get cut. There's no getting out of this. I'm going to be bloody, sliced up. I just need to protect my throat and my arms, and I have to, my only chance is to just rush this guy as second he hits the ground, grab him, and just start hitting him, and hitting him, and hitting him, and hitting him, and I think, I might actually have to beat this guy to death just to survive. And I think, Mom's not going to like this. And right out of that, though, I had this other thought, which was, his mom's not going to like this either. And I want to point out that I know I was like this close to losing my humanity. I was this close to doing something that I could never take back that would have haunted my conscience for the rest of my life. It probably would have ruined me. But I'm so proud right now that I can look back on that and say, in that moment when I was scared and when that guy was wanting to hurt me, I was still able to look at him and see that it was a human being, that he had a mom, and that he had feelings and all these things. And I'm glad I did, because of that empathy, I was able to think for a second. And I was like, there might be another way out. And I looked to my right, and sure enough, there's another little alley right there that I didn't notice because I had tunnel vision. I was so busy thinking about beating someone to death. And the problem is there's a big wrought iron fence on this one. It's the worst thing to be trying to scramble over when someone's coming at you with a razor. And I'm so lucky, though, because somebody, and I don't know if it was those kids or other kids in a similar life situation or junkies who had their own life's hell, had pushed a washing machine up against that fence. I took my chance, and I ran. I jumped on that washing machine. I leapt over that fence. I landed on the other side with a whole hell of a lot of stuff to think about just as a cab rolled up. Thanks.
That was Shane Castle, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Thanks for tuning in. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you, too, could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chloe Chobel, from the Alaska Teen Media Institute. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Sam Burnett.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come, and I love your lips, wanna give me some. But we fuss and fight when things go wrong. Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?
We'll just have to see what will we will be. We can swim or sink in our new beginning. Oh, I'll just let it be. No more inquiries, darling, I'll need no more reassuring.
Things are looking up, you're the best of them all. Will I keep my word? Would I have resolved? Eat a little less pork and be nice to you all. Don't need to know what the future stores. Just need your touch, who can ask for more? This year, will my face look the same? Will we fall in love, or just fall like the rain?
We'll just have to see what will be, will be. We can swim on the sea in our new beginning.